You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
So, my final task, Greenbelters, is to introduce you to the person who is going to introduce the person. So, sat on stage, we have Malcolm Doney, writer, a part of Greenbelt, he tells me, since 1976, although he has been home since. He's one of those unpaid Anglican priests, and he is going to introduce you to Tim Winton. So can we have an enormous round of applause for Malcolm and then for Tim?
Okay, greetings. Hello, everybody. We have here a discreet collection of bibliophiles ready to meet our friend Tim Winton. This is how it's going to work. Have we got Tim on the stage? No, we haven't got him on screen yet. He will appear in a moment. I've been a friend of Tim's for over 30 years, and I don't get to see him very often because he lives on the other side of the world. So I'm going to be a bit greedy because I've got lots of things I want to talk to him about. But that will be in public, and we'll all be part of that conversation. But I don't want to be that greedy because I know, I'm sure that you'll have questions that you'd like to put for him. Perhaps I could just have a quick straw poll. Has anybody read any of Tim Winton's books here in the audience? That's about 80%, so that's good. That's great. So I'm sure you'll all have questions that you will like to put to him. This is how that's going to work. So when I've stopped asking mine, if you'd like to ask him some questions, I'd like you to write those on a piece of paper. Now, there are people wandering around with bits of paper, so if you haven't got a piece of paper and you would like to write a question, please raise your hand, and those pieces of paper will make its way to you. Then they'll hand them to me, and then I'll ask them of Tim. So, let me introduce to you Tim Winton, who is a prodigious author who has written 13 novels, 30 books all told, is an enormous environmental activist, voted as a national treasure in Australia, which of course he is, and we're very, very pleased to have him with us today. So will you give a very warm Greenbelt welcome to Tim Winton? So Tim started writing when he was at one of the early creative writing courses in Western Australia, and amazingly managed to get his first book published while he was still a student, and that won a big Australian prize, and that's never stopped him since. He lives in Western Australia, near in just north of Perth, and has been there very much since. As those of you who've read him will know, his books are very much earthed in Australia and the landscape around the coastal regions there. So I'm hoping I don't have to talk to you and tell you about Tim for a long period of time, because that'll be very dull. But we'll wait and see what's happened to the visuals in just a sec.
Malcolm, can you say how you met Tim?
Yes, I met Tim when he was over in Dublin, and he was on a writing fellowship when he was writing a film, a book called The Riders, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. I was living in North London in Crouch End at the time, and a fellow Australian had put us in touch. So I'm pleased to say, I think, that we have Link.
Yay!
He looks frozen. Are you frozen, Tim? Yep, he's frozen. Let's carry on. Okay, so... yeah, Tim was writing a book called The Riders, which was shortlisted for the Booker Prize that year. Ah, you're unfrozen. Tim. Good. G'day.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. This is a privilege. Good to see you.
We should have just got a bit of string and two jam tins.
Yes. That would have worked just as well. Excellent. So I've been blathering on, filling in before your presence arrived. So I'm grateful for your that you're here. Let's set some context first. So, and if you were, you look like you're in the dark there. It's just some ghostly figure. But actually, I imagine the sun is shining where you are. What can you see if you stepped out of your front door at the moment?
Well, the sun is just about to finish shining where I am because we live at the other side of the world. We've already had Friday morning. We're just leaving you the leftovers. But out the front of my place, you can there's the ocean, which is a big humpback whale nursery. In fact, the most significant humpback whale nursery in the world. And out the back, a big red range and an arid landscape.
Brilliant.
And the sun's just going down.
Okay. So you grew up in this part of the world, in Western Australia, and you grew up in a working class family, and you say that the seeds of your writing life were sown when you were sitting under the table at mealtimes. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I guess I came from a modest background where people had primary school educations mostly, but my family were great storytellers, and if they weren't great storytellers, they just talked a lot. Mm-hmm. And I remember being.
We've lost you there for a moment. Can anybody see the?
No. I often just listen to the sound of the voices and the vernacular, and I guess I absorbed a lot of stories and a kind of a storytelling instinct and I guess storytelling lore, L-O-R-E, I suppose. It was a kind of the thing that fed me. And because we grew up in a fundamentalist church, those stories of the family and the great mythology of the scriptures and the tradition were also a big part of it. So I guess I was born into an ocean of story.
And were you an outdoor boy or an indoor boy?
By and large, I think I was an outdoor boy. Indoors was like captivity, it was us, children being domesticated when we were wild animals. But I did develop I was educated into a kind of a daily pattern of indoors and outdoors. I went outside to be in the natural world and to essentially run amok. But I, we developed this pattern of coming indoors when it got too hot or too windy, and we would just read. So we had a life of the mind, I suppose, and an interior life balanced by this love of the outdoors and just a kind of a, we had our feet in the soil, I suppose, or in our case, it wasn't much soil, it was just sand and seawater.
You were saying that you brought up in a kind of fundamentalist Christian church, the Church of Christ out there, and the Bible was a big feature of your life and your family life, is that right?
Yeah, unquestionably, it was it was the beginning and the end in all. It was the stuff that fed us, I guess. We, you know, as I said, we, you know, people didn't have much education, but they were educated in the scriptures, and I think the scriptures and these kind.
Let's give him a moment. See whether we get some back again. Just a word on the Church of Christ. Oh, right, he's back. Yeah, sorry.
Tim. I'm back. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah, it was in a tradition where the scriptures were like a form of agency to working class people, where, you know, we'd be in these study groups and we would talk about the scriptures and study them, and we were sort of steeped in them. And I guess it was a way where, you know, modest people, poor people could educate themselves in a way. So we weren't rich in every tradition, but we were certainly rich in our own.
So at what point then did you consider yourself to be a writer? Was that quite early on?
Yeah, I was 10.
That's very specific.
I can still remember I made a sort of public declaration, you know, which was also part of my tradition. There was always a point in our tradition where you declared yourself and got baptized. So that was like, I'm on this side of the line or that side of the line. And in terms, I just felt, I felt convinced at the age of 10 that I was going to be a writer. So I sort of declared this publicly to everyone in my class at school, who all thought that was a great joke. Because, you know, and it was a great joke. I'd never met a writer in my life. I never met a writer until I was 18 years old. I didn't really know what I was signing up for, but it was the first idea I came up with, and I'm sticking with it.
Right. So how did that go down with the family and the church?
Oh, I think my parents were sort of tolerant and loving about it. Probably a bit horrified, but also they had the. They had the kind of consolation that I was 10 years old, so I would obviously come up with a better idea. And as the years progressed and I failed to come up with a better idea, they supported me. They didn't really know what I was up for either, apart from what, you know, we all assumed was a life of poverty. As I grew into my teens and started to write and to publish, because I started publishing in my teens, there was probably more discomfort in the parish, in the church community. It was pretty alien. It was a bit strange, and a bit threatening, I suppose, because it was outside people's experience, as it was outside mine. I was simply making myself up as I went along, it was awkward.
I wonder whether anything to do with your vocabulary, because your vocabulary is poetic but also very earthy and vernacular and sometimes quite sweary, frankly. Was that evident from the start?
Probably not as evident as it is now, but I was looking for profane ways to write about the sacred. I was convinced from childhood that the world was good, that the material world, the organic world, was good, that it was holy. I didn't know that, you know, William Blake had said that all that lives is holy until I went to university, but when I read those words, I knew them already. I was having something sung to me that my body already knew and my spirit already knew. So I was trying, and Blake's an interesting avatar in a way, not just because he was the first and great British nudist, but because he was convinced about the holiness of matter. And that's and the profanity, I mean, profane by embodied, with all the blood, and sweat and shit involved, and lots of other writing about the sacred was somehow leached of all bodily fluids and all earthly elements, to the point where it was very abstract and as a result extremely anemic.
So let's talk about the landscape a bit, because the landscape is in a sense a character in your books, and often I believe it's more than just set the scene for your writing. It's kind of, the landscape has been the essential starting point of your stories. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true, Malcolm. I mean, I start with landscape. The story comes out of landscape. I'm proceeding according to the ecological logic of the place where the story's set, and so I don't. I think it's deeply disrespectful to the creation to be always assigning it a background status, as if it's backdrop, as if it's some kind of oil that you daub up behind the players, and pay, you know, the attention paid to place is always secondary or tertiary. So for me, what the story is generated by organic reality. It comes out of nature. So the things that happen in that story can only happen in that place. So, yeah, you're right. Landscape always comes first, and the figures emerge from it as if from a kind of a, I don't know if you've ever seen those westerns where, you know, looking across a shimmering salt pan and you don't know what you're looking at, and eventually you see a speck, and then it sort of resolves itself as a cowboy, and he's carrying his saddle, and you know, you're already seeing a story. You know, he's probably shot his horse, he's probably eaten it or done worse, and our story's begun before anybody says anything. But it comes out of that salt pan.
Yeah. And in fact, your working life has been in the landscape. I mean, I remember when I first met you, I was very jealous. You were telling me about your working day. You'd get up, you were living in a small lobster fishing town, and you'd get up in the morning and feed the chooks and collect the eggs, and then get in your tin boat and sort out the lobster pots, and then you'd come home and write. It sounded like some kind of utopia to me. Is that your writing life now? What does it look like? What does your day look like?
No, it hasn't changed that much. I don't know if it's utopia. I mean, peasant life always looks utopian to the middle class. But yeah, I still live according to the weather and the tides. I work nearly every day. I get up early. If there's swell, I go surfing. In the summer, I pull my lobster pots. And somehow I managed to get a day's work done in the afternoons. I might go for another swim, or, you know, go for a walk in the bush. I'm still that 10-year-old boy. I'm living in two worlds, and they are the one world, the life of the mind and life in nature. And I guess when I'm working, I'm trying to process the things that I'm experiencing out in the world. I'm not just trying to describe them. I'm trying to understand them, and I'm trying to maintain intimacy with creation, with, you know, with the divine. So it's, yeah, it's a, I've been doing this for 40 something years now. If you can think of a better pattern, just feel free to let me know. I'll try and adjust, but I'm a pretty old dog now.
And obviously, you know, as you've intimated, you've spent your life in what for us here would be a pretty extreme climate. And those conditions have become gradually more extreme. Was there a moment when you first noticed the change, or was it a kind of evolutionary thing?
Well, I've been looking intensely at the environment for, you know, most of my adult life, and I've been engaged in the environmental movement for most of that time as well. I guess when it just became, and I guess there's a difference between intellectual knowledge, you know, and I've been, you know, studying what we used to call in high school the greenhouse effect back in the 70s, you know, all my life, and understanding the changes in climate. But when you have knowledge in your body, when your body registers what your mind is, you know, been storing away for years, you kind of own that knowledge in a different way. So yeah, it was about 2011. We had a marine heat wave on the west coast of Australia, and we thought that was bad. But what happened that summer was we found millions of birds on the beach and wondered what was happening. And what was happening was that all the abalone, the mollusks off the reef that we've relied on for food for since childhood, all the abalone had slowly been, the water temperature had gone up and up and up, and all the abalone were fleeing the ocean for somewhere cooler. And they climbed out like a million snails, climbed off the reef and onto the beach, where they baked to death in the sun, and all the seabirds in the world seemed to arrive to eat them. So it was a cataclysm, and it was a huge wake up call for us and for me personally. And then climate became pretty central to my sort of extracurricular work, shall we say. I sort of work half of my working life as a professional freelance fiction writer, and then the other half I spend as an organizer and a rabble rouser for the environment movement, and climate's become pretty central.
I wanted to ask you about that. That was there a particular hinge point when you stopped just being a writer and then became an activist, which you've absolutely quintessentially are these days?
Yeah, I think there was a point where in the very early, or in 2000, in fact, I used to go every year to dive on Ningaloo Reef in the northwest of Western Australia, you know, one of the world's last great sort of pristine coral reefs. There was a point at which that reef was coming under development attack from sort of white sharks, as we call them, in this part of the world. In the lead up to that, I'd been sort of quietly working in the background as an organizer, but not publicly. And that was a point where it was a kind of break glass moment for us. We just couldn't figure out any other way to bring the plight of the reef to the attention of the national and then international public without me, wheeling me out publicly so that the media would show up. We used to joke that to bring the sharks, you need some blood in the water, and I was the blood in the water. And the trouble with that, I mean, it worked. It was a very successful, a bit of a gruesome campaign to live through, but it was very successful. The problem was that, you know, once I'm out of the box, I'm out of the box. You can't, you know, once you put your head up over the parapet, there's no retracting it. So I've been doing that stuff ever since, and so it's a big part of my life.
I mean, it's obviously very important, and as you say, you've been quite a figurehead for that. But do you feel that's uncomfortable? Do you feel it a distraction from what you really do, or is it all part?
I think it's me just submitting to my citizenhood. You know, I'm a I'm a citizen. I don't buy the whole modernist idea of the artist as some sort of part of some priestly caste where, you know, all the normal obligations, social obligations, you know, somehow fail to apply. You get some special leave pass never to have to contribute. So I think it's part of my obligation, not just as an artist, but you know, as a parent. I've got three kids. I've got six grandkids. When you can feel and measure the natural world around you shrinking and being diminished and being poisoned, any parent would want to, you know, fight for. I mean, essentially, the natural world is the true economy. These are the conditions under which we live, and these are the basic, you know, the clean water and air and soil are essentially the basics for life. These are what our children and grandchildren will depend upon, and you know, that's their inheritance. And so, you know, I think every parent wants to fight to leave their child something, and I guess the measure of that for me is always Bonhoeffer, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the pacifist Lutheran pastor who somehow got himself involved in the plot to kill Hitler. He said that, you know, you can gauge the quality of a society by the world that it leaves its children, and I think that was it's a very potent moral line in the sand. You know, you will be judged. You know, the nature of your morality will be judged by the kind of world you leave to your children. So for me, it's yes, it is uncomfortable. I don't like the public stuff much. I'm not naturally a fighter. But part of my role, traditionally or historically, in the last 25 years, is to perform alliances, to bring people together over generations, boundaries, and political boundaries, regional boundaries, to form alliances and coalitions to do good things. And but there's a lot of conflict involved, and I find that a struggle.
I'm interested how this does dovetail with your fiction, though, because, I mean, you've said before that while stories are important, they're not functional, and you describe them as, I think the word term you use is useless beauty. But your latest novel, Juice, seems to be more committed than that, if that's the right word. Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, I guess it's committed in a different way. I mean, just to go back to the useless beauty idea. I just don't think art needs an excuse to exist. And beauty doesn't need an excuse to exist. And I think that, you know, we can creation tells us that every day. There's an American poet called Katie Farris, and she posed this question. You know, why write love poetry in a burning world? And she answers it herself, you know, to train myself in the midst of a burning world to offer poems of love to a burning world. And I think holding up beauty is really important. But I mean, Rilke, the German poet, he said that beauty is but the beginning of terror that we're still just able to bear. And I think what he's talking about here is the space between us and oblivion, or what I've been referring to lately in my speaking and writing as the fire front, this kind of narrow habitable space that we now have to live in. And if it wasn't clear before the climate emergency, you know, it's pretty obvious now. I don't know if you know the Christian anarchist philosopher Jacques Ellul, but he said that we find faith on the razor's edge. And the beauty and terror of existence are intertwined. And so, yeah, I think all art is that's honest and authentic, is committed. Anyway, but yeah, I did write a novel that's probably a little more in your face, shall we say. It's particularly on climate, and yeah, it's a book set quite a way in the future, and the idea is that we have failed Bonhoeffer's idea of a moral society, that we have, you know, it's based on the idea that we have just walked away from our responsibilities to the future, that we're essentially bad ancestors, and the world in the future is extremely hostile, and quite a large swathes of the world are uninhabitable, and those people who do live in the world are living really reduced, diminished lives compared to ours. Should I describe anything more about that, or is it?
Yeah, I mean, if you wouldn't mind giving us
wait for the musical. some people would describe this as dystopian, but these are the people who aren't visiting the places in the world where people are already living in dystopia. But it's a world where, you know, everything's, you know, 4 or 5 degrees hotter than it is now. For instance, you know, in the winter it's in the mid 40s, and in the summer it's in the 50s, right up into the high 50s. And I don't know how many people in the audience have ever experienced 50 degrees Celsius or centigrade, but I think it's about 125 or 6 in the old money. It's exciting for about 5 minutes, and then it's terrifying. So, you know, the idea of a world where that level of heat is constant and almost inescapable. So it's set in Australia, and it's really it's about those people who discover why the world is the way it is, because of a series of collapses. Technology, you know, doesn't exist in the same way. You know, there aren't any satellites, so there's no phones. There are no nation states. And people are reduced to very small settlements and federations, and they have to, you know, they have to live 6 months of the year underground. Living in a place where it is, it was 50 degrees last summer, where it'll be, you know, up to 45 degrees for 2 or 3 weeks in a row. And the experience of that level of heat means that even with, you know, the kinds of houses that we have, the kinds of air conditioning that we have, even with air conditioning, you know, when it doesn't get below 25 degrees at night and it gets up to 45 degrees every day for a few weeks, you wake up every morning and you have less charge, if you like. You have less energy in your body than you did the day before at the beginning of the day. So by the time you're 2 or 3 weeks in, you're quite diminished. You're kind of enfeebled, and you become very irritable and very nervous. And that's, I don't know how many people have ever experienced heat stroke, but it's a kind of terrifying thing. It makes you feel this sense of doom. I mean, apart from the throwing up and the fainting and everything, you do get locked into this sense of doom. So imagining a life where that's your basic reality rather than a kind of a few weeks of the year that you've got to get through. It was an interesting experiment for me, both a thought experiment and a moral experiment and a kind of a technical experiment, and you know, based on the, you know, the kind of grimmest scientific modeling that we have available. It was an interesting thing to morally imagine myself into the world that my grandchildren's children might face, and on the balance of probabilities, given our, you know, current public policy settings in terms of climate, it's a future more rather than less likely to await them.
But it's not just a description of that. It's also a kind of climate thriller, isn't it? In the sense that the unnamed narrator in it decides to take action, quite violent action, against the people he believes is responsible for all this, which is quite an interesting area.
Yeah, it's interesting is one way of putting it. There is this point at which the person who's telling us this story, as a 16-year-old, he discovers why the world is the way it is, there have been so many generations who've lived post collapse that people just assume that there's been no kind of continuous handing down of history. There's been so many kind of breakages culturally and in terms of communication. So people just think that the world was always like this. And the moment that this young man finds out that the world is like this because of the way people used to live and how they produced energy, and the kind of luxury that they lived in, and the fact that they knew what it was doing to the world anyway, I guess it, this is a kind of the most... I was raised in a tradition, was a kind of an unfolding of bounty and beauty and awe and wonder. This is the kind of the most negative form of epiphany that you can imagine. He's kind of a... This is a revelation of ashes, where he realizes that, you know, his forebears were monsters, and that he's living out the consequences of crimes that were committed before he was born, and all the suffering of his people and his family, his village, is the direct result of the way other people knowingly lived. So I guess they're living the fruits of late stage capitalism, the nihilism of late stage capitalism and fossil capitalism in particular. And so it's a legacy of humiliation, I guess, is my point. And the humiliation of that revelation curdles something in him. And I guess that's something that I've been interested in for a long time, the way the really enormous, potent and endless force of humiliation. When we humiliate people, groups of people in particular, we damage them and we do something to them that sort of metastasizes in them. And I think we see the fruits of humiliation on our feeds and on our screens and, you know, in our newspapers every day and every night of every year. People who are humiliated and oppressed and occupied and robbed and sort of generationally cursed, if you like, sometimes the only thing that they feel that they have available to them after they've exhausted all other passive and decent forms of, you know, seeking amelioration. In the end, they take revenge, and they resort to violence. And yeah, so this guy becomes recruited into a global resistance movement where they take revenge against the oligarchs and corporations whose heirs and scions are living in places all over the world, in the same bunkers that have been built probably for the last generation, and will be built at faster rates every year into our heating reality. But so it was slightly new territory in that sense of trying to understand and trying to unpick, you know, this legacy of humiliation and the ways in which people will be forced to respond to it once they, because eventually, you know, records will be kept. Even if you break down all forms of communication, people will be leaving messages for our descendants. People will find out who did what, and there are endless examples from history when people discover something later, they act on it.
You've said that if we don't act against climate emergency, we're somehow complicit in it. Is that true?
Oh yeah, I think the fact of that is sort of unavoidable. I mean, I think there's enough, you know, those of us in the more prosperous countries that have access to communication and education, I think we know enough. The days of not knowing enough or being uncertain about the science, those days are behind us. So I think we are, you know, this is the greatest moral challenge of our time. Obviously it's one among many, but it's the preeminent moral challenge is, you know, what are we leaving to the future? And also, how are we honouring the divine force, you know, the mighty force, the life force? How are we honouring the divine by consigning its works to oblivion and somehow becoming comfortable with the idea of offering a legacy of ashes to those unborn? I think as you know, you're either on the side of the money or you're on the side of life. You know, there are, I've spent most of my life trying to avoid Manichaean propositions, but this one's just pretty clear. You know, you're either on the side of life or you're not. And to be passive in the face of what's happening is to be complicit. And I think there are multiple challenges. The rise of fascism and authoritarianism is one of them. And one thing that history has shown us is that if you appease fascism, if you remain comfortable in the face of rising authoritarianism, you do become complicit. And I think the bravest of people have been those who stand up and say, I don't want to be a collaborator. I want to defend what's true and what's precious. And the world is precious and the people that it makes are precious and the people who are sustained by that world are precious. And, you know, somebody in the book does say that when nature dies, religion dies. And I think that's true. I think it's very, very difficult to maintain a religious tradition in a world where nature is dead. I think the natural world is the first revelation, and the barriers to meeting the divine in a world without creation might be insurmountable, and that worries me. I mean, I you know, the Bach the greatest architecture in the world, the poems of William Blake, even the TV show Bluey. I don't know if anyone's seen that little cartoon. All the great things that are of the world are from the world and could only come from this world. And I don't, you know, the idea that we would accept the destruction of this world and think that we can still be humans with spiritual aspirations in a colony on Mars, I think you're kidding yourself.
The book's called Juice. Why is it called Juice? What is juice?
On a very literal level, it's energy. It's the means by which people make their gear go. And obviously, in the world of the book, most of that's renewable energy. People have figured up enough about solar energy and wind and batteries to be able to sustain themselves. So they're constantly, you know, worrying about, you know, whether their batteries have got enough juice. But juice really is also physical courage and moral courage. People ask each other, have they got the juice to keep going? Or in a difficult moral situation, people ask themselves, have they got the juice to make the right decision? And so it was just one of those words that for me kept on giving. I guess I'd spent years immersed in some of the kind of grimmest facts and some of the grimmest possibilities of life. And, you know, as I said, 6 grandkids, I'm you know, deeply concerned about that. So I was asking myself a lot during these last few years, you know, have I got the juice to keep going? And when I do know I have the juice, it's because of what the world gives me, and that stems from the organic reality that, you know, has been dispensed to us. The world gives me enough, either in the face of a child or in the face of a humpback whale or the belly of a whale shark or just the weird squitches and colors and dots on an octopus that's trying to eat my foot. There's enough awe and wonder and beauty and holiness in the world to keep me going. And I think human relationships are a big part of that, but they come from nature. We have this bizarre idea that we are not part of nature. We talk about humanity and nature, but, you know, nature produced us. There is no humanity without nature. And, you know, I think if you go back and look at the scriptures, you'd be struggling to imagine a religious tradition if you scrubbed out all the natural history. You know, Moses is kind of confronted one day by a burning box, or somebody goes up the steps to bring down some tablets. You know, there's no mountains, there's no rivers, there's no. I guess the thing that that I'm obsessed with at the moment is watching my own species expel itself from the garden again. We are making ourselves homeless, and it was a tragedy the first time. It'll be more than a tragedy the second time.
Amen. I have a couple of questions here from this dedicated audience here. And one is that this is from Nigel, who's read all your books, who asks how your writing has changed now that you're the grand age of, 65? Because you've been writing a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I started in my teens, as I said. I'm not sure how my writing has changed. I know how to keep doing it. You would have thought after 45 or whatever it is years that you'd get better at it, or that you would know what you were doing some of the time. But honestly, every day I'm all at sea. I feel no more competent than I did when I was 19. But I have to say that I'm a bit like a kid who's just thrilled to be able to ride the bike. You know that moment when your mum or your dad or your big brother lets go of the back of the bicycle and you realize that you're doing it on your own. One of the great joys of life is just being reminded that, you know, I don't know what I'm doing, but in terms of the writing a lot of the time, but I am thrilled to still be able to be doing it. And now and again, you know, when I ride the bike right, I can produce something that, you know, people respond to. But yeah, I don't know how my writing's changed over the years. I'm probably the worst person to ask.
Another question is, your work speaks truth on different topics. What at the moment is your most essential truth? I guess we've talked about that to some degree, but
yeah, I guess going back to my preoccupation about, you know, beauty and terror being entwined, and the courage to keep going in the face of the you know, the fire front, as I call it, is vital, and the solidarity that we have to maintain in order to generate that courage. You know, I think that might be the most precious human resource that we have available to us. And I guess fostering solidarity amongst people and between people and creatures in the natural world, I think is our most immediate challenge. But I think it's possible. We've seen this done over history, that people come together to face an emergency. They somehow see their neighbours, they see into their neighbours' lives. They see them as people all of a sudden rather than objects. And so I think fostering solidarity is, I don't know if that's a truth, but it's certainly an aspiration.
A couple more questions. These are kind of linked. Somebody asks, the loss runs through your writing in terms of your human characters. It seems integral to your work. Is this something that you felt compelled to express at the start? And linked to that was asking about the hero of Juice, is saying, was it a challenge not letting your hero lose touch with his humanity? So it's about losing stuff.
Yeah, obviously it's a huge challenge to write about somebody who becomes, you know, completely overtaken with a concept of vengeance. or you know, in any way that you want to take that in terms of disciplining yourself to clean the world of something. I think what happens over the course of the book is the guy is essentially rescued by his humanity, and there's some kernel in him which does seek civility, does seek solidarity, does want to cooperate with people. I mean, he basically late in the piece that the only future that humans have is by cooperating with one another, by laying down their arms and sharing the load. But yeah, really difficult to be in his head for a few years, and also to because he never gets named, as you say, but it was important that he is not this kind of repellent figure, that he is somebody that you can imagine yourself being given the right, i.e. all the wrong circumstances.
Another question, which is, how can stories of climate repair begin to address despair?
Well, I think we need to celebrate our victories, and there are plenty of instances where we are making ground, and this is not just to kind of fall back on the old trope of believing that technology is going to solve all our problems. Technology will be a part of solving some of our problems, but most of what is going to contribute to solving our problems is humanity, all the deep traits of decency and imagination. But I think those things are producing wins all over the world, and I think we need to celebrate those wins, and also we need to celebrate the bravery and the prophetic voices of young people all over the world who are speaking up and putting their bodies and their futures on the line, and who are being persecuted by authorities, essentially doing the interests and the bidding of corporations. But I think we need to celebrate those moments where we see courage and we see breakthroughs and we see good work being done. Otherwise, we fall into despair, and we just can't afford despair. Despair is just a form of surrender. It makes bad outcomes certainties when they are not certainties.
That's a very good point which to end. Before I thank you formally, obviously the book is available in the bookshop, and I believe other titles of yours are, so people should get there and read your stuff. We're hoping that in next year or the year after, people might see a film of The Riders. Is that correct? Is that shooting next year?
Yeah, that's shooting in February. I think they start in February. Somebody called it Bradley Pitt is in it, apparently.
Excellent. Is there any news on a film of Juice? Sub judice, say.
Yeah, it is. The actual news is sub judice, but there is a big studio film about to be announced, and that'll be that'll be interesting. But I always thought maybe the casting could have been interesting. Sorry, I'm just having a bizarre thought, but I won't share.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to end with, there's a line which meant a lot to me in Juice, where your narrator says, humans are not just destroyers, we're makers. And you, Tim, are a maker, and I think we all want to thank you for what you make.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.